From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with novelist Toni Morrison. Her bestseller, Jazz, is set in Harlem in the 20s. It's about people who migrated from the rural South to the urban North, like Morrison's parents did. Also today, we talk with one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history, Tom Seaver. Next month, he'll be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by saxophonist Ernie Kribda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The European Community's negotiator in Bosnia said today that he's made no progress in getting the warring parties to agree to a ceasefire. Lord Peter Carrington met separately today with Muslim, Croatian, and Serbian leaders. Bosnia's president reportedly told Carrington that he won't discuss peace until there's been a 7-day ceasefire and an international guard is set on all heavy artillery. The Bosnians have also refused to meet with the leader of the Serbs, calling him a war criminal. There were new reports today of more heavy fighting around the Bosnian capital. The first plane carrying U.S. aid to Bosnia since fighting broke out nearly 3 months ago landed at Sarajevo Airport today. Deirdre Berger reports.
The U.N.-sponsored airlift of food and medical supplies to the besieged residents of Sarajevo started as planned today, despite sniper fire near the airport. Two U.S. C-130 cargo planes, two British and an Italian plane, landed safely. The cargo jets carried a total of about 50 tons of humanitarian aid. The supplies were taken by United Nations officials to central warehouses in the city. More than 1,000 members of U.N. peacekeeping forces are in control of the airport. Airlift officials say they hope the joint European Community and U.S. aid effort will soon bring 200 tons of supplies a day to Sarajevo to help alleviate growing food shortages. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger reporting.
African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela today rejected President F.W. de Klerk's accusations that his organization has been trying to seize power through a campaign of strikes and demonstrations. Mandela also flatly turned down a new offer by de Klerk to restart political negotiations. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports from Johannesburg.
Nelson Mandela's vigorous rejection of President de Klerk's speech could have been expected. He characterized as false any suggestion that the ANC was planning to seize power by force. That denial, however, doesn't sit easily alongside the statements of several prominent figures in the ANC alliance in recent days, who have spoken of removing President de Klerk from power. Mr. Mandela, however, was at pains to stress that the ANC was still committed to negotiations. I understand that several figures prominent in the fight against apartheid in the past have expressed reservations about the politics of mass action. Among those to question the wisdom of the tactic in these volatile times has been Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who has appealed to demonstrators to show restraint. Yet the ANC's grassroots support and its powerful trade union allies show no sign of relenting in their pressure for a more militant approach from the leadership.
The BBC's Fergal Keane. President Bush has signed a bill that would extend unemployment benefits by as much as 26 weeks. The measure sailed through the House and Senate yesterday after the Labor Department reported that unemployment had reached an 8-year high in June. It's the third extension of unemployment benefits since last year. This is NPR News. President Bush is threatening to veto a defense spending bill because it contains a provision that would allow military women overseas to get abortions in military hospitals. The patients would be required to pay for the procedure, and doctors who object to abortion could refuse to handle the cases. The amendment would change a 4-year-old Reagan-Bush administration policy forbidding abortions in military hospitals. The president has said he'll veto the whole $252 billion defense measure if it comes to him with the abortion provision. The measure was co-authored by Representatives Les O'Coin, an Oregon Democrat, and Ronald Mockley, a Republican from Rhode Island. Scientists studying Sunday's major earthquakes in Southern California's Yucca Valley say they believe they've found a link to movement at three volcanoes in Northern California. Frank Stoltz of Station KLON reports.
Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park say the Yucca Valley quake set off a sudden surge in mild jolts at the Mount Shasta, Mount Lassen, and Long Valley volcanoes. They say it's remarkable because the volcanoes are more than 500 miles to the north. The 1989 7.1 Loma Prieta quake triggered a similar increase in activity, but not more than 65 miles away. Scientists say the increase in shaking at the Northern California volcanoes doesn't mean there's any increased risk of larger quakes or volcanic eruptions in the area. They say it's increased their workload, though, sending them scrambling to develop theories to explain how an earthquake in the Yucca Valley could have affected underground stresses over such a huge area. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
Northwest Airlines has cut its workforce for the third time in 2 weeks. The Minnesota-based carrier said it's laid off about 235 reservation agents, bringing the total layoffs in the past 2 weeks to nearly 600. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When our book critic John Leonard reviewed Jazz, Toni Morrison's current bestseller, he described it as a magic act and called Morrison the best writer in America. Jazz is Morrison's sixth novel, her first new one since Beloved, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1988. Jazz is set in Harlem in 1926 and is about African-Americans who moved from the rural South to the urban North. It's also about love, jealousy, violence, and aging. A woman named Violet finds out her husband has been having an affair with a younger woman who he has killed. At the funeral, Violet takes revenge on the corpse. Here's Toni Morrison reading from the opening.
I know that woman. She used to live with a flock of birds on Lenox Avenue. Know her husband, too. He fell for an 18-year-old girl with one of those deep-down, spooky loves that made him so sad and happy he shot her just to keep the feeling going. When the woman, her name is Violet, went to the funeral to see the girl and to cut her dead face, they threw her to the floor and out of the church. She ran then through all that snow, and when she got back to her apartment, she took the birds from their cages and set them out the windows to freeze or fly, including the parrot that said, "I love you." The snow she ran through was so windswept, she left no footprints in it, so for a time, nobody knew exactly where on Lenox Avenue she lived. But like me, they knew who she was, who she had to be, because they knew that her husband, Joe Trace, was the one who shot the girl. There was never anyone to prosecute him because nobody actually saw him do it. And the dead girl's aunt didn't want to throw money to helpless lawyers or laughing cops when she knew the expense wouldn't improve anything. Besides, she found out that the man who killed her niece cried all day. And for him and for Violet, that is as bad as jail.
That's Toni Morrison reading from her new novel, Jazz. You know, the woman who cuts the face of the dead woman, a character later says to the woman who does the cutting, "I don't understand women like you, women with knives." Do you understand women with knives, kind of crimes of passion like that?
Not entirely. I think part of the reason I was interested in the story and in that period was some way to figure out the impulses for violence as a sort of notion of solution and how it plays into notions of license and freedom. So it was a quest, really, on my part. I'm not quite sure I understand that kind of excess.
Was there a particular crime that you wanted to understand? Or a particular woman with a knife who you wanted to understand?
The woman I really wanted to understand was Dorcas, the young girl, who is based on a historical figure, actually, a young girl who died in Harlem at a rent party, shot by her lover with a silencer, and who refused to let anybody help her because she wanted to give him time to get away, and waited so long that she bled to death. That was extremely provocative to me, that notion of that kind of romance that probably is representative of someone that young. Her acceptance of his violence, the way in which a young girl or a woman deals with assault, under certain circumstances in certain eras and periods.
What's the closest you've seen to this in real life?
I've never seen any of it. I mean, I don't... If I had seen it or participated in it, I probably wouldn't be so interested in writing about it. But it's what I... It was sort of outside one's own personal experience that is compulsive.
No family legends or neighborhood legends from when you were growing up?
Not about women. About men, yes, who were championed because of their endurance and their response to violence associated with them. But the women that I knew were, I suppose, in a manner verbally able to deflect violence. There's a passage in jazz about the kind of women who needed a certain kind of protection. There were those who had razors taped to their hands. There were those who were willing to boil a lie, and those who were willing to put ground glass in food. But there is a secondary passage which explains what a large majority of black women did in terms of trying to protect themselves. The church, the club movement, the acquisition of property. I think the line goes, any black woman in 1926 who did not share some of those protective gestures was silent or crazy or dead.
Hmm. Toni Morrison is my guest. You have this sense in your novel, Jazz, of people coming to Harlem or coming to the city and feeling more like themselves there, more like the people they always believed they were, is the way you put it. That's obviously something you were really interested in developing in the story, just what it meant physically and emotionally for people to move to the city. You must have stories about that in your family history.
Oh, I do, yes. That move from the rural areas where I think in literature sometimes we romanticize into the freedom of the countryside, you know, the sort of ability to commune with nature and be one's transcendent self. And there is that mythos in literature. And there's an accompanying one, which is the freedom of a city. On the one hand, there's a certain kind of anonymity. But more particularly, especially for African Americans, it was moving into an area where there were so many of you. You could see yourself in your number. And there was a certain kind of protection in that, as well as some license. Also, it was, I don't know, the idea of a city as being a place where there is a mix, where there are many classes, many kinds of people. And however eccentric you are, there are, you know, at least 100 other people who are eccentric in precisely the same way. So that one has solitude, solitariness, individuality, and community in a city. I'm not sure we can think up a city like that anymore. But that's what the ideal is. And that's why, you know, when we think of New York in the 20s or other large urban areas in our either invented mechanisms or actually historically there, what was the innocence and the sin, the excitement and the comfort of being in a huge metropolitan area? And I think that, you know, impelled and compelled African-Americans as it did immigrants. There was a risk there, but there was enormous opportunity, and there was some safety.
Would you share with us one of your parents' migration stories?
Yes. I think one of the ones that I remember best was when my mother's parents left the South, left Alabama. My grandmother's husband, my grandfather, had gone to a large city to earn some money playing the violin, as a matter of fact, and she was alone on their farm with these children who were very, very young. I think my mother was 5. And there was some danger about. It was the time when a woman alone with several children was a kind of a target. And her words were that when she noticed white boys beginning to circle that house, she had to leave immediately. So she sent word to her husband, to my grandfather, by somebody who was en route to tell him that she would be on X train at X time, and that if he wanted to see them again, he should be there. And so they left in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, because there's always debt in that sort of sharecropping situation that most post-Reconstruction black people found themselves in, and went to Birmingham and got on the train. And as the train pulled out, there was no Papa. And the children all began to wail and cry. And a few miles outside the city, he appeared, but he hadn't felt that he could show himself at the station and get on with them, because they were escaping that cycle of debt, you know, that round that you can never really escape, because, you know, the commissary of the general store you need for the feed, and that takes the crops, etc. So it was a happy event for them. And then the subsequent stops on that route to where they were headed, looking for work from mines that were asking for laborers, for mills, for women who could work in service, is an interesting and very typical story. And they ended up on the shores of Lake Erie, where I was born.
In Ohio?
Yes.
What was Lorraine like when you were growing up? What kind of neighborhood were you growing up in?
It was an interesting place. I still think it's remarkable. In that part of Ohio, and I think in many of those states, I never lived in a black neighborhood. Because what we were living in were really just poor neighborhoods. So that I grew up with all of the other immigrants who were coming to this country. I'm thinking, as I speak to you now, of the house where my mother lives at this moment. And the people on the street are named Tershak and Galini, and my mother and a black woman named Mrs. Ross and so on. That's always been the case in that town, because it was a steel town. And people were coming from Mexico, from Eastern Europe, from Scandinavia, from everywhere, as well as black people coming to these centers just after World War I, and in some instances before, in order to find work. So we had a kind of town that was, I don't know, all the ideals that are probably purely rhetorical, existed in that little town. However, everybody, whether they were Polish people or what they used to call Slovenes in those days, had their own halls, churches, and, you know, family life. That was not mixed. You know, you didn't exchange on those areas in those days. But there's one high school, four junior high schools, and we all went to the same school.
So what was the African-American cultural center? Was it the church, or was it something else? The church?
Absolutely, the church.
And you'd go every Sunday? Beyond Sunday?
Well, they had a very, you know, complicated social life. Mm-hmm. Part of it was Sunday, part of it was Sunday school, but a lot of it was taking care of each other. Mm-hmm. And what I remember most is the impetus and the necessity for my mother and her friends and for all of us to take food to people who needed it, or to go clean somebody's house if they were bedridden. All sorts of chores were taken for granted. When people got old, they didn't have any place for them to go. And if their families were indigent or couldn't take care of them, that was the responsibility of the women of the church or of the neighborhood. It was just a constant part of one's life. I think in The Bluest Eye, I recorded something similar that really happened, which is my sister and I would sleep in the same bed, and we might wake up and there might be a child next to us, somebody who was in difficulty, or the parent was sick or gone, and women in the neighborhood would take them in. And there might be some children living with us for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or months or what have you. And we were not, you know, it was a kind of violation of what everybody seems to think is important now, which is intimacy and privacy. And of course, as a young girl, I wanted to leave it. But at the same time, it was a kind of sharing of other, you know, of responsibilities, social responsibilities. No one ever talked about it and said, you know, you ought to be a responsible member of the society. But everything people did was like that.
Well, it would seem to me that in your adult life as a single mother writer and editor, that you would have had precious little time to devote to the community. I mean, because you had to be so busy with bringing up your own children and, you know, earning a living and writing and so on.
It's true. I had precious little time. I didn't think of it that way because I understood my work to be very much bound up with service to mm-hmm. the community. But what I missed, I'll have to tell you, was the community service to me. You know, I understood that if I lived in Lorain, Ohio, and I was working and I had small children, I wouldn't have to get a babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would do that and ask me, did I need help? Or, you know, those kinds of things on the block or on the street were people who watched your children because they took that as part of what being an adult was like.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Toni Morrison. She has a new novel called Jazz. She also has a new book of literary criticism called Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Toni Morrison is my guest. In your new book of literary criticism, Playing in the Dark, you write about how until recently American readers were assumed to be white, and you wonder what that assumption has meant to the literary imagination in America. When you started reading, were you conscious of reading books in which there were few, if any, black characters?
No, I was conscious of there being a sort of disruption in some books when black people did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a kind of embarrassment, a kind of a need to skip over those parts in, say, being in the 10th grade and reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, or seeing children's books in which, was it Sambo? I mean, you know, these kinds of things. And you sort of politely erase them from your consciousness until you get older. And then when I became a writer, I had to function in a language that was coded in a number of ways. And I had to work with those codes. I didn't have access to some of the metaphors and shortcuts that, say, a white writer has who feels he or she is unraced. And they can take for granted the centrality of their experience because it is white, and they think that's being without a race. Everybody else has race. White people don't. They could take for granted that kind of centrality, and they could use cleverly, brilliantly, effectively or not, as the case might be, the presence of black people, just as they frequently did the presence of women. It's sort of something you have in your kit.
So when you say that the language was coded, let me get you to elaborate on the kind of code you felt you had to cut through or work around.
Well, calling slaves slaves instead of laborers or workers is one code. Using black women and men to appear in a scene for no reason other than to provide the tension that might suggest illegal sexuality mm-hmm. or violence. They have no other function except to define and to suggest to be the association of. And you wonder, why are they there? And they may never be picked up again. But they have this impact. To have classical American literature to need to establish virtue, power, and dominance over something, and to need an obedient black person or someone who loves you irrationally. Mark Twain's Jim is irrational in that sense. His love is boundless, and he's a grown man talking to children. I could not do that, say, with a white man who was an ex-convict.
I think it's fair to say that in most of your fiction, there's really been very few significant white characters.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so how does that relate to what you're talking about now, about the, you know, about the code and...
In a sense, having... It would be silly for me to write or to concentrate on major white characters because I wasn't interested in it, and also it destabilizes the progress of the narrative in a way. For example, putting a young black girl center stage seemed to me a radical thing to do in 1965 when I first began writing The Bluest Eye. Once you begin to permit the reins of the narrative to be held by a major white person, you lose the agency and you lose the terrain, the imaginative terrain, because you may be forced into responding to a white presence instead of examining what the interior lives of these people are without the constant need to explain, to editorialize, and to fix. So it was an enormous liberation for me, and one that I find to be repeated a lot, particularly in the work of black women. Once you take those people out, then it's as though the whole world is available now for one's own creativity. But in a sense, it's all a little bit more real than that. White people were not central to my life. They were out there, sort of on the edge, sometimes wonderful and enabling, sometimes hostile and disabling. But the heart of the life, even in the town that I described, was in our household, in our family. So that in the novels, I wanted to, in that sense, not have characters who were always required to do what I don't think we were required to do, is to consistently think about what white people were thinking. It makes you reduce them in some sort of stereotypical way that I would shy away from. But certainly I was interested and fascinated by and sort of thrilled by a number of minor figures, that is, secondary figures, enabling figures in who are white, such as Amy Denver in Beloved, who is not required to be a white person in that scene because she's not around any other white people. So she can go ahead and be a person. And also, she does something I think that almost never happens, if ever, in American fiction, which is to have a white person touch a black person with some motive other than sex or violence.
Toni Morrison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Toni Morrison's latest novel, Jazz, is on the bestseller list. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pitcher Tom Seaver wasn't just voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. He was voted in by the largest margin any player has ever received. It's an honor that caps a career as one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. Coming up, we talk baseball with Tom Seaver. He'll be inducted into the Hall of Fame next month. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by saxophonist Ernie Krivdom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Czechoslovakia's President Václav Havel was defeated today in his bid for re-election. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Prague.
Václav Havel's defeat marks the end of an era and is seen as a signal that Czechoslovakia is inexorably moving toward a breakup. Havel was supported by Czech conservatives and social democrats and opposed by Slovak nationalists and communists who swept to victory in elections last month. He failed to be elected even in a second ballot in which only a simple majority was required. Havel, a dissident playwright who had been jailed many times under communism, in 1989 steered what he called the Velvet Revolution that toppled the regime. He was a founding member of the Charter 77 dissident movement, and his humanistic philosophy and eloquence made him a natural leader. But in elections last month, the centrist parties inspired by his ideas were swept out of power and out of parliament. The winners were conservatives in the Czech Republic and nationalists and communists in Slovakia. This is Sylvia Pojoli in Prague.
European Community negotiator Lord Carrington said today he failed to make progress in talks on stopping the fighting in Bosnia. Carrington said he has no plans to return for another meeting with the warring sides. Both the Serbs and the Bosnian government rejected an EC proposal to divide Bosnia into three ethnic regions linked by a central government. After Carrington left, fierce fighting broke out in Sarajevo. Heavy artillery rounds crashed into the western suburb of Dobrinja. Machine gun fire, mortars, and loud bursts of anti-aircraft fire were heard around the city. The firing came close to the hotel where United Nations forces are staying. Constant firing could be heard near the airport, which was secured this week by UN troops. The United Nations chief in Cambodia, Yasushi Akashi, has met with Khmer Rouge leader Khoo Samphan in an attempt to resolve the deadlock between the UN and the Khmer Rouge. UN officials and the four Cambodian factions failed to reach an agreement yesterday on who has the ultimate authority during the transitional period between now and next year's elections. From Phnom Penh, Sue Downey reports.
The Khmer Rouge are refusing to cooperate in the UN peacekeeping mission until this question of authority is resolved. And a one-hour meeting between Khoo Samphan and Mr. Akashi at the UN headquarters in Phnom Penh failed to reach agreement. As he left the UN building, Khoo Samphan said the meeting had been useful and progress was being made. Mr. Akashi also said it had been a positive discussion, and another meeting between the two leaders is scheduled for Monday. For National Public Radio, this is Sue Downey in Phnom Penh.
President Bush has signed a bill giving jobless Americans up to 6 more months of unemployment benefits. Checks for thousands of Americans were to end after the weekend. Congress quickly passed the legislation yesterday after the government reported unemployment has hit 7.8%. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has the tough task next week of convincing the Group of Seven leaders he can lead his country out of its economic troubles. Yeltsin will give a 4-hour presentation to the summit in Munich on Wednesday. His sales pitch could determine whether the G7 goes along with a $24 billion aid package planned for Russia. New data show Russia's unemployment will continue to rise and production will continue to slip until 1994. President Bush backs Yeltsin, as does Canada's Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Yeltsin's aides have warned recently of a coup if the money isn't approved, but that move could backfire by causing doubts among international lenders who don't want to pour money into a potentially volatile situation. The crew of the space shuttle Columbia is just a few days away from setting an endurance record, but the time spent in orbit may not be enough. Dave Pindinelli of member station WMFE explains.
Shuttle Commander Dick Richards did a little bit of lobbying today for NASA's planned space station. The crew conducted its third in-flight news conference and said they needed more time to complete their work. Astronauts have been busy conducting experiments aboard the shuttle's microgravity laboratory as the end of the mission draws near. Commander Richards says the crew could get a lot more work done if it could stay in orbit for months rather than days. The goal of this endurance mission is to build up the time an astronaut spends in space, eventually leading to a year-round manned space station freedom. The space station has been the subject of heated debate lately, with one House subcommittee recently voting to cut funding by $1 billion. Despite the pleas from space, though, Columbia is due back on Earth next Wednesday, completing nearly 13 days in orbit, a record for a space shuttle crew. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The man accused of killing two people and wounding three others in a Fort Worth, Texas courtroom this week remained in prison without bail today. George Lott has confessed to the crime. He's been given permission to defend himself in court. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This year, the Baseball Writers Association voted Tom Seaver into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Seaver was a pitcher for 20 years and won 311 games while in the majors. Only 12 other pitchers have passed the 300 mark. The team he played with first and stayed with the longest was the Mets, and he helped turn this losing team into World Series champs. Since retiring after the 86 season, Tom Seaver has been a broadcaster for the New York Yankees. He's also become a wine collector, gardener, squash player, and skier. And he's immersed in baseball history. He's co-written a new book called Great Moments in Baseball. Seaver will be going to Cooperstown in August for the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. When the balloting was in, Seaver won by the largest percentage ever. I asked him how he took the news.
My initial reaction was total disbelief, and it's a kind of thing that is really reserved for the other players. They're kind of reserved for the people who were my idols when I was growing up. Those are the people. I think it's you always, at least in some sense, maintain that kind of relationship with the history of baseball. It is a game of idols. It is a game of worship, and it's a game of when you're a kid wanting to be like somebody. When I was, I wasn't necessarily a kid. I was a student at USC. And prior to that, too, but my two heroes were Sandy Koufax and Henry Aaron. And I loved their approach to the game. And I loved what they did as professional athletes.
Any of the great moments in your book, Great Moments in Baseball, moments about you?
Oh, no.
Why not?
I'll let somebody else put those in. Let somebody else write those books. I think it's not about me directly, but I think with some of the things that go on in baseball, Terry, become part of you. I mean, when I sit there and read about Walter Johnson and how he had these great confrontations with Three Finger Brown with the Boston Red Sox and the Washington Senators. I mean, just this piece of history, I think that becomes part of you and has become part of me before when I was going about my business. But there's nothing directly about me in this book, no.
Had you worried as a player what you would do after retirement? Did you not want to be in the position of thinking that all your most wonderful moments were behind you?
Well, not necessarily. I don't think wonderful moments is the right phrase. I think that your point is well taken. I did not want to be 38 or 40 years old and say the most rewarding and most challenging things I've ever had are gone and are behind me. That's a fair statement. I did not want that to happen.
How did you decide when the right moment was to retire?
I was on a bus ride going from O'Hare Airport to downtown Chicago, and it was about 2:30 in the morning, and I looked out the window, and I could see my reflection in the glass of the bus, and I just looked and I said, "What in the world are you doing on this bus?" And that was the final moment, and I said, "It's time to get out of here." I had gotten past 300 wins. I had gotten past 3,000 strikeouts. You know, unless you're Nolan Ryan, I mean, those are the normal things that that we mortals set goals. That's where we set them, you know. And so I'd gotten past those two aspects of what most every pitcher would love to achieve, and it was time was time to get off the bus. It was time to stay away from LaGuardia Airport. It was time to stop working 7 days a week.
You retired after the 86 season. What kind of shape is your arm in now? Does it ever give you trouble?
No, my arm. The only thing that bothers me is my left arm. This is after I was done as a player, and I felt I didn't want to hurt my right arm, and I guess instinctively, so I put all my weight on my left shoulder, and my left shoulder still hurts me, and my left knee hurts me. But from a throwing standpoint, I have no problems whatsoever with my right arm.
Do you still throw a ball?
No, I don't pick it up because I can barely throw it about 50 feet now. I don't throw. No, I don't. Those days, Terry. Those days are gone. Believe me, they
right.
really are.
Let's go back to 1967 when you joined the Mets.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mets were, I mean, this real losing team. I was living in New York then, and mm-hmm. everybody always made jokes about the Mets, although mm-hmm. everybody sang the theme song, too. I think maybe they were the only team with a theme song. Well, anyway.
I don't remember. That wasn't that, the
you don't remember the Meet the Mets theme song?
The theme song was not, that was not my department.
Right. Well, did you want to play for the Mets, or were you sorry that that's where you were landing?
Well, if I can take you back and walk you through a little piece of Tom Seaver history. I was a student at the University of Southern California, and I signed a contract to play with the Atlanta Braves after I'd been drafted by them in 1966. And that contract subsequently was negated because the University of Southern California had already played a couple of games on their schedule. And then Walter Byers, in his ultimate wisdom, decided that my intent to be a professional was enough to take my scholarship away. So here I was, by the professionals, I was an amateur, and by the amateurs, I was a professional. I was neither fish nor fowl.
And you couldn't play with anybody.
That's right. And I lost my scholarship. Now I'm out of school. And so anyway, I called the commissioner's office, and I said, this is unfair to me. And they decided that anybody who would be willing to match this contract given to me by the Atlanta Braves, which was for about $50,000 back then, plus the finishing my education, could put their names in the hat. And there were three teams, the Cleveland Indians, Philadelphia Phillies, and the New York Mets. And he told me about that prior to the selection of the team. But I remember talking to my dad about it. I said, gee, you know, if I go with the Mets, they're expanding. They probably are looking for young talent. And if I'm going to get to the big leagues, my chances are best with the New York Mets. So at that time, I was glad to be with the New York Mets because it was probably understood that it would be the quickest route for me to get to New York and get to the big leagues.
Do you remember the first game that you won?
First game that I pitched was against the Pittsburgh Pirates. I got a no decision, though. No, it was a fellow named Chuck Estrada, who was one of the baby birds, one of the great young pitchers that the Baltimore Orioles had back in the early 60s, and he won the game. And the next game I pitched against the Chicago Cubs, and I don't know the score, but I remember I won that ball game. And then I won my next game in Chicago 2-1. I remember that.
And
after that, we jumped right to 300. We skipped 288 games.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Tom Seaver, one of the great pitchers in baseball history. Will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in August. He has a new book called Great Moments in Baseball. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Seaver is my guest. How often were you in pain when you were pitching?
Not very often, Terry. I was very fortunate. I had for a 20-year period, a pain-free career. I had hurt my shoulder in Cincinnati. I got sick in spring training and tried to come back too fast and ultimately hurt my shoulder in 1983. That was a very scary moment for me because I'd never really been hurt. But one of the things, and we talked a little bit about this before, one of the things that I tried to do is understand the mechanics and the physical aspects of pitching. And I felt that if a pitcher was going to pitch a great number of innings over a long period of time, that the stamina had to be absorbed in the bigger muscles from the waist down, and your rear end and your thighs, and it couldn't be absorbed in the smaller muscles of the throwing shoulder. I mean, that just was logical sense, and I developed an excellent mechanical style.
Now, you're talking about putting the stress on the larger muscles.
Mm-hmm.
I think during one season you pulled a buttock muscle,
mm-hmm.
and that must have really kind of ruined that system.
It does for a while. When you go to throw a ball and it feels like somebody is sticking an ice pick right in your left cheek, and you know you're going to have problems. There's no way you're not going to have some sort of physical problems. I mean, but if you're going to have them, one of the things I always preached was that if you're going to have problems, have them in the lower half of your body. Have them, you know, don't have the problems upstairs. Don't have them in your shoulder or your elbow. If you're going to pull something down in the bigger muscles of the body.
What's the most tired you ever got during a game?
I think the most fatigued one time, I think I was 40, I was probably 40 years old, and I was pitching on a Sunday afternoon in Baltimore in July. First part of July, it was about 93 degrees and about 98% humidity, and it was a 3-1 ball game. And I was just, I was done. I was, and Tony La Russa was the manager, and he wouldn't come to the mound, and he never came to the mound. I looked over a couple of times to see if he was going to come on and give me the hook and get me out of there, and he was hiding in the dugout. He thought I was still throwing extremely well, but I was exhausted, absolutely exhausted. But we won. We won 3-2. I gave up a home run in the ninth, but we won 3-2.
Do you think that life is very different, or that the game has changed, or, you know, even the salaries for the younger players today compared to what it was like when you were coming up? And are there things that maybe even alienate mm-hmm. you about the game today?
Uh-huh. There's nothing really in the game that pushes me away from it or alienates me. I still love the game of baseball, and it's a fascinating game when it's played. It always has been fascinating when it's played well, and it's a terrible game when it's not played well. And I felt that way as a player, and I feel that way as a broadcaster, and I feel that way sitting here talking to you today. One of the obvious difference in when I played and the game today is the amount of money that is in the game. It has a chance to affect the game from the standpoint of you may not see anybody reach 300 wins again. You may not see anybody achieve 3,000 strikeouts. You may not see anybody achieve 3,000 base hits. The reason I say that is that these players are going to make so much money in such a short period of time that they're not going to have to go through that period of a career where they have to contend with an injury. They have to contend with a subpar season. They have to contend with a sub-performance season later in their career. And I think a lot of these young players are just going to make so much money that they get an injury or they get a certain amount of time. They say, I don't have to do this because financially I don't have to anymore, and it's no fun. You know, it's no fun being 8-15 one year, maybe because your shoulder hurts. And you're going to have to go through that. Every athlete from DiMaggio on down has had to do it.
What was that period for you? Were you real? If you could have, you would have gotten out, but you felt like you had to stay in it and work through
right.
a really bad period.
Well, we talked about that before. I got sick in spring training, and I was with Cincinnati, and mm-hmm. the club started badly, and I tried to come back too quickly because I knew they needed me, and ended up hurting my shoulder, and I was 5-13.
Right.
And one year I was 11-11. I had some shoulder, you know, minor shoulder problem. Nothing major, but enough to affect my performance.
Yeah, but probably you could have left. You probably had enough money. I mean, if money was what it was finally about.
Well, money is part of it. Money is part of the equation. I mean, obviously, you can have to put kids through college, and you can set yourself financially. Certainly today you set yourself financially for the rest of your entire life without ever working again if you don't want to. But also, you reach a point where you say, listen, you know, I'm 34 years old. If I can play six more years, I got a chance to win 300 games. if I average 15 a year. Now, it's easier said than done, but that's how you look at it. You reach the point where all of a sudden numerical goals become a possibility, not a distant dream. And that's what keeps you going.
Tom Seaver. Next month he goes to Cooperstown to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams with a word about what's coming up later on NPR's All Things Considered. Václav Havel has been voted out as the president of Czechoslovakia. Bit of a political upheaval there. The government of Iraq is denying that a coup attempt has taken place. It's reported that a military convoy tried to get into Baghdad, was attacked, and the coup leader was killed. I'll talk with members of a Somali family now reunited in Virginia after years apart. They're all learning English. The young ones are being mainstreamed into the schools. They all like Batman and Married with Children. Also, Roadside America. We'll talk with the proprietors of some of the country's leading attractions. That and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
In jazz, if you want to get noticed, tradition says you go to New York. But what if you're a first-rate improviser who chooses to stay at home? Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says chances are you'd be as famous as Ernie Krivda. Ernie who?
Ernie Krivda lives in Cleveland. Yeah, that's right, Cleveland. Butt of a thousand jokes. It's a nice town, he likes it there, and they got a great bus station, so what's it to you? Ernie Krivda also plays the tenor saxophone uncommonly well. He's got what jazz fans like, a big tone and plenty of rhythmic drive. He'll even play familiar tunes. Krivda works a lot in the Midwest, but he's not what you call famous, even in jazz circles. I'm tempted to say he'd be famous if he lived in New York, but he did live there for a while in the 70s, and it didn't happen. With bassist Jeff Halsey, one of a dozen players from Northeast Ohio, heard on a new CD called Ernie Krivda Jazz. It's on the Cadence Jazz label. This is his 9th album, more or less, and Krivda's sure of himself as a leader. Working outside the spotlight, he's developed some good ideas that might not have occurred to him in New York, like featuring Pete Salvaggio on 2 cuts. He plays some of the best jazz accordion since the late great Leon Sash. Ernie Krivda has said that he's influenced by more than saxophone players, acknowledging the particular inspiration of gypsy violinists. But on this track, called Irv's at Midnight, He sounds like he's echoing Pete Salvaggio's accordion. They get the same asthmatic low notes. Krybda is Polish, and I think I hear some polka inflections in his waltz Little Face, although he doesn't. It has to do with the way his phrases expand and contract rhythmically. His sense of time has accordion pleats. As a born-again New Yorker, I think the idea jazz musicians have to live here in order to prove themselves is pretty wacko. Jazz isn't some fragile hothouse flower you can't transplant, and jazz musicians are just like other people. Some like big cities and some don't. They may find inspiration in the complex flavors of a Louisiana gumbo, or the moo of a Montana cow, or the glow of a fire on the Cuyahoga instead of the bright lights of Broadway. Besides, all jazz fans should have to go to New York just to hear a good show? Hey, Cleveland, I hope you know how lucky you are.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in Brooklyn. It's not Ohio, but he likes it okay. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Seuss Bolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross, and we all wish you a good 4th of July.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Timothy Phelps was one of two reporters who broke the Anita Hill story, leading to a second set of hearings during the nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. On the next Fresh Air, we'll discuss Phelps' new book about the Thomas nomination, revealing secret agreements, political infighting, and media manipulation. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Annual concert from the Capitol Steps in Washington, D.C. You'll hear the National Symphony Orchestra. You'll hear